Okay. Hi, Eric. This is Garance.
Hi, Garance.
How are you?
Fine, and you?
Well enough. I'm sorry I haven't seen you in a while. It's been months.
Yeah, that's none of these people's business.
Oh, okay. So we'll just keep this very... we'll just pretend we've never met.
Okay.
No, I think...
Well, now I'm making it worse.
So wait, okay. Can I just ask, was this your idea or was this Bob's idea that you and I should talk?
Bob's idea. As Bob knows, okay. I don't do anything but plug the computer in and talk. Anything else, you know, he can't afford my raise.
Oh, okay. I thought perhaps he suggested it because after the animal testing, he felt I should, you know, do my next episode with somebody that I had conversations with previously.
That is so hostile of you to bring that up. I can't believe you would do that.
Are you going to hang up on me?
What is the matter with you? I mean, if we had talked about it ahead of time and you had said you were going to bring it up, but now that you're bringing it up, I don't... All right, go ahead.
Yeah.
So well, you want to talk about
it? I think we actually did talk about it ahead of time, actually.
I had talked about it with her ahead of time, too. So, yeah, so let's talk about you and Anne for a minute.
Yes. Well, I just want to set the record straight because this came up in a couple of subsequent episodes, in particular with Bob Wright and Michael Kinsley, and there was some discussion about whether or not this was some kind of like an ambush against Anne. And I just want to set the record straight that there is nothing of the kind there. In fact, I don't think I'd spoken with Jessica Valenti for an entire year previously. I'd seen her, met her once at a conference in Boston, and. I think March or April of 2006, and subsequently we're on a listserv together, and we maybe exchanged a couple of emails over the course of a year on this listserv, but there was nothing going on in the background.
I didn't even know we had Kinsley on this. Now I'm feeling like, you know, this is a classier joint than I realized.
Well, I've been trying to describe Blogging Hits to people as, you know, the crossfire of the blogging set,
yeah.
and it's becoming more like the crossfire of the crossfire set now.
So. It's an insult to everyone concerned. So listen, the thing about... I want to talk about Anne for a second. First
okay.
of all, as I mentioned on Altercation that day when the feces hit the fan, Bob had asked me to debate Anne a few months ago. And I had never heard of Anne. I had only heard of Anne once in my whole life. I understand she's a law professor, although I'm not familiar with her work as a law professor. But I had only heard about her. I said, here's a woman, and I didn't know anything else about her, who was being critical of another woman for being photographed near Bill Clinton while having breasts. And, you know, I'm a busy man. I have a lot of jobs. I didn't really have time to get to the bottom of this. So I thought, well, if I'm going to do this blogging ad thing, I'm awfully curious as to how anyone, whether she called herself a feminist or not, I had no idea. Apparently she does. How anyone in the world could defend that argument. I can understand snarkiness, you know, and the sort of power line of a power line sort. But I wanted to have a conversation, a civil conversation, where I very politely say, excuse me, I just don't get it. And I wonder if you could walk me through the argument, because how is it anyone's fault for having breath? And so, but this discussion she and I had took place in email, and I was rather short. I think I was polite, but I said, look, I don't care what we debate. As I said to you, I don't care what we debate. I just want to know why, I just want to hear your explanation for why it was so bad for this woman to have breasts. I didn't know Jessica Valenti's name at the time. And she said, well, you know, she took this very badly. And I thought I had an agreement with Bob that's, like, I only agreed to talk to her, I told Bob, under these conditions. Anyway, she took it very badly, and it seemed to me that she was sort of creating excuses not to have it. And then finally she said, well, I don't really see the point of talking at all if you're going to insist on fixating on this one episode, which is now long past. And maybe that's true. Maybe she was right. But my point is that when she flipped out with you, she said, well, it would have been all right if we had agreed ahead of time to discuss this. But if you bring it up now in this context, which, by the way, nobody on earth, I think, understands what the hell she meant by that, then I would have been willing to discuss it. But I brought it up in exactly that context, and I would have just said to her, Anne, take it away. Explain to me what you had in mind. And she wasn't interested in doing that. So the whole thing is a bafflement to me. It's a bafflement to me why in the world a woman would make this case. Maybe you can, on her behalf, make the case that you think she was making. But B,
well, my understanding.
Let me just finish B, and then you can have the whole rest of the blogging answer for Mrs. Weiss. B, why in the world she would flip out and call attention once again to the fact that she had taken this crazy position when she seemed to be going beyond that. You know, she had that column for a month in the New York Times where she attacked me, as well as on her blog. And it looked like she was sort of getting out of the right-wing blogger's ghetto. And then, but with you, all she wanted to focus on were these really, really narrow issues of commenters on tap had said nasty things about her. Not even people on tap, commenters on tap.
Which was not something we had agreed to talk about. I mean, yeah. I did not intend to go into this having a discussion about comments on tap. And in fact, most of the comments that she was talking about were not on tap, which is why I didn't know what she was talking about. It turns out that they were on Ezra Klein's personal blog and on Scott Lemieux's personal blog that he runs with Rob Farley and others. Mm-hmm. And so they were just not things that I had been paying as close attention to.
How dare you?
In any event, my understanding of her perspective is that she's one of the women who believes that Bill Clinton is someone who should be anathema to feminists. So therefore, any feminist who meets with Bill Clinton is betraying the cause. Mm-hmm. And how that relates then to Jessica's breast, I missed that transition, but I think that's her underlying objection. And she does do a fair amount of writing about things that seem designed to call attention to sexuality in ways that she then objects to. She had a post recently on a building that looked phallic, and then she posted another thing about a stadium, I believe, in Texas that was designed from the top in such a way that it was reminiscent of a vulva. And, you know, and I just think if you're going to be posting a lot about people's body parts and buildings that look like body parts, then, you know, obviously people are going to mock you if you're in the political blogosphere, because that's just how it is.
Yeah.
You know, people, it's you know, if you're running an art blog or if you're running an entertainment blog or if you're running a more cultural blog, but I think it's hard to run a political blog and have people take you as seriously if you're going to do that kind of stuff. And, you know, she posts a lot of pictures on her site, and that's why I asked her if she was a conservative, because I, you know, in the scans of her blog that I'd come across, you know, it was primarily cultural coverage and not politics at all. And so from the cultural coverage, you didn't quite get her politics, but looking more closely at her politics, I see that she is, in fact, conservative and was, in fact, you know, involved in a conservative blog diva contest the previous year, and so she's somewhat in that niche. You know, I think she did raise one interesting question, which is about conservatives in general and how they treat people who they see as sort of disaffected liberals, because I've also had this experience where I have a number of, you know, conservative friends here in Washington from having done reporting, where you'll write something about someone, and because it's Washington and it's a tiny town, inevitably, the moment you write anything unpleasant about someone, you're destined to run into them at every available opportunity until you finally start having conversations and, you know, or become friends or whatever. And so, and they love having me around as a token liberal and inviting me to their things, and it's bizarre.
Well, you're very pleasant to have around.
But I just think it's amusing, you know, and they're very friendly to people who they consider sort of the token liberal that they like having around. And so I think it's a role that conservatives have that they find engaging. And I think maybe it's because, you know, in magazine life and in the media world, you know, I think it's pretty clear that people in general tend to be a bit more culturally liberal, although not necessarily politically liberal.
No.
And so someone who is a writer and a conservative perhaps feels a bit more culturally isolated. And so they do a kind of reaching out that I think people who are more liberal don't necessarily feel as much of a need to do, because they're already a norm.
Well, I actually do try and reach out to conservatives personally whenever I can. I'm always looking. You know, Lionel Trilling made that famous comment in 1949 or so, that liberalism was in danger of growing flaccid and all kinds of terrible things because there was no conservative intellectual tradition in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm constantly, for two reasons. One is sort of self-serving, which is I think it helps my reputation to be able to, as an honest liberal, to be able to point to conservatives whom I admire and agree, with whom I agree and whom I admire. But also, I want to sharpen my own ideas and test them against conservative ones. And so in New York, which is a little different than Washington, at night we don't take politics seriously. So I'm going to a book party tonight for a friend of mine, and there'll be people who I have attacked in incredibly intensely in print, and I'll be perfectly pleasant to them if they're in fact pleasant to me, and we'll just ignore the whole political thing. In Washington, that doesn't happen quite so much.
You know, I don't know. I think the conflict is at perhaps higher levels or something, because I feel like there's a lot of back and forth at the in circles that I know.
Anyway, maybe we're using this as a transition to another topic, but I'm always looking for conservatives that I can be friendly with and exchange ideas with. I used to enjoy doing this with David Brooks very much, but I feel like he's gone over the deep end. I went on a National Review cruise and I made friends with a few conservatives. Richard Brooks.
How was that? I want to hear about that.
Oh, well, I wrote a great piece on that, if I do say so myself, called Heart of Whiteness.
All right, we'll have to include that in the links on the sidebar.
Yeah, I don't think it's linkable. I think it's in the book, The Best of the Nation, 19-something to 19-something, but I don't think it's ever been online. But,
right, well, we can probably grab it off of Nexus and put it online somewhere.
Oh, that'd be good. That'd be fun.
Yeah, we can do that.
Anyway, I had a really good time, and I had a lot of interesting discussions. I was treated as kind of a zoo animal on that cruise.
That would be the token liberal role again.
Yeah, but I'm always looking for conservatives that I can feel that I can with whom I can respectfully disagree, and I feel like George Bush has so corrupted the conservative movement. The Bush administration has so corrupted the conservative movement that there's almost none left. I did an episode. The last Blogging Heads I did will never be seen by you people. I know there's going to be a lot of crying in the comment section over this because Jonathan Chait, something went wrong technically, but he and I spent a few minutes discussing which conservatives we continue to learn from and to admire. The name I always bring up is Chris Caldwell, which is a pretty popular name.
Well, he's a fantastic writer.
Yeah, and a really thoughtful journalist. I mean, his work on Islam in Europe is great, regardless of your politics. I like Rick Brookhiser, too. I think he's a decent fellow and one who you can talk to and disagree with. I don't feel this way about Brooks anymore. I feel like sort of the ascension of Jonah Goldberg is an example of just how intellectually bankrupt, how much conservatism is a kind of movement shtick rather than, you know, a thoughtful position. I think Jonah was once much more thoughtful than he is. The idea that he can publish a book about liberal fascism to Hillary Clinton, it's just so, I mean, you can't even respond to crap like that. So I'm wondering if you, Jonathan Chait, he wrote this out recently. He picked out Ramesh Ponnuru of National Review, with whom I meant to start getting familiar, but I haven't really done it since. I'm wondering who you would put in that category of conservatives, who you learn from, and who against whom you can test your ideas.
Well, I mean, I don't know if people still consider Andrew Sullivan a conservative, but he seems to consider himself a conservative, and I think, you know, his blog is very interesting, and he has a real a sensitivity to things that go wrong in the world in a way that you don't often find on conservative writing, which is always so disdainful. Let's see, who else would be...
I'm going to take a pass on all Andrew-related matters.
Why? Is there some backstory?
You know, it's funny. I'm just not getting any support anymore for my hatred for Andrew. It's like, even, you know, people say, just give it up. And I say, you know, because it's the same. It's an interesting issue. I keep bringing this up. It's the same issue I have with Peter Barnard, who is a very nice guy and a real gentleman. But Peter Barnard has written apologies for his position on Iraq of almost poetic quality. But he has never addressed the issue of why he felt free to treat those with whom he disagreed with such withering contempt, as if we were idiots and we were anti-Americans and we were not patriots. I believe the term that Mike Tomasky quoted of his was living on planet Chomsky. I believe that's Beinart's term. In any case, he used the term pacifist. Andrew wrote the worst things that anybody has written about those who opposed, about those who hold the view, who held the views back then that he holds now, about people who could have saved the country had they been listened to, all of the tsuris that it's gone through when he was still saying, he was still wearing a George Bush cheerleading uniform. Now, he's very, very good at saying...
Can I just interrupt for a second?
Sure.
I feel like that's a whole debate that I've been watching people have with each other for, you know, close to the last year, sort of relitigating the war.
Yeah.
And I sometimes feel like this is a debate that is really not taking into account the fact that this war would have gone forward whether or not these people supported it or did not support it. I don't think that Peter Beinart's opinion on the war was going to change George Bush's mind.
That's absolutely true. But why the reason it matters, aside from the fact that, you know, I was called a traitor to my country by the person we're discussing, which rather rankles. But the reason it matters if you're not me, if you're just someone else, is that these same people are like the Washington Post editorial page, Andrew, the New Republic, they're still insisting on the right to guide our thinking about foreign policy in the future, particularly about wars in the future, particularly about Iran, say. And, mm-hmm. and it's absolutely crucial for me to say, look, why should I listen to you? If you got this last thing so wrong, if you can't identify to me why you got it so wrong and why you're not going to get it equally wrong in the future. And I haven't seen that happen. I hear them say, look, I was wrong. It didn't turn out to be WMD. But I haven't heard anybody say, look, with a slight exception of Beinart, with a partial exception of Beinart, I haven't heard anybody say, look, here's what was fundamentally remiss about the way I approached this. And here's what I've learned. And here's why next time I'll know better, and I'll be a more responsible guide to the future. And when I look at someone like Hitchens, who repudiated his entire previous career in order to support this war, I say to him, look, if you were wrong for the first 45 years of your life, what is it about your judgment that would lead me to follow it now that you've got a completely different view? And he can't explain how it is that overnight he switched from someone who was partying with Gorbidal and Noam Chomsky on one boat and then jumped onto another boat and was getting high with Paul Wolfowitz and Bill Kristol. I need to understand that intellectual evolution in order for me to trust it. And that's what I haven't seen in these people.
Well, I mean, I don't know Hitchens particularly well. You probably know him better than I do, as someone who, you know, worked for the same magazine as him for all those years.
Well, we were close friends, actually, in the olden days.
Okay, but, you know, I sometimes actually wonder if, you know, being at the Nation for a very long time, because it's such a unique liberal environment and so much more to the left than probably any other publication, major political magazine in America, has an impact on people and makes them, creates a kind of contrarianism. And I was wondering this about Ann Altas as well. You know, she's been a professor at University of Wisconsin-Madison since 1984, and I imagine living in Madison, Wisconsin since 1984 has an effect on how you view politics in this country, so that you might get a certain cachet from tweaking the majority perspective.
I don't know, it's a little funny. Christopher and I are both columnists at The Nation, and so we're never, he was, and I still am, and
right.
I'm proud to be one. But you're never actually there. But you do get sort of feedback from the institution somehow, even if your editors happen to even if you have a good relationship with the editors, you still get sort of grumbling, most of it in the form of readers and people you meet and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand this about Christopher's evolution, which is there's nothing more annoying in life than a holier-than-thou leftist saying, you're not as moral as I am, you don't have the courage that I do, and that's why you've sold out on this issue, whereas
right.
I'm still upholding the flag of revolution, and you're a sellout.
Right, and virtually every single person on the left will be attacked with that exact analysis, probably at least once a quarter, and depending on what you write, you know, once a week.
It happens all the time.
It happens constantly, and it's one of the more annoying things about writing in sort of left precincts. And I think, you know, I mean, that kind of... I feel like a lot of this stuff was a lot more, it was more cultural than it was really political. It was about the aesthetics of political positions rather than about the actual positions themselves.
Well, this is one, that's a fair point, but I also think this may be one case where, I hate this expression, but that the personal is political. I mean, the thing is you get enough of that and you really start to resent the side from which it's coming. And yeah. and the other side is, you know, welcoming you with open arms because they love converts, you know. It proves mm-hmm. that they were right the whole time. You know,
right.
I've never...
Right, I mean, like, there's the whole book that just came out, you know, Why I Turned Right. It's a whole book of conversion, of these conversion stories, conservative conversion stories.
Yeah, I suppose I need to look at that.
It's actually, you know, some of them are very interesting. I mean, I found David Brooks' piece rather endearing, actually, because, you know, I also grew up in Greenwich Village, so I sort of understand that kind of Alex P. Keaton reactionary impulse that people can have growing up in an environment like that. And some of the other ones, it's not clear that they actually ever were anything other than on the right, such as Rich Lowry. He, you know, grew up very conservative in Virginia and was one of these people who describes himself as having been in high school, you know, just loved to tweak people and it was a conservatism of just sort of sticking it to people, and you could sort of see that as a continuum.
Yeah, well, that's the way I spent a lot of time with Lee Atwater, believe it or not. And he described growing up in South Carolina where the entire establishment was Democratic, and it was a big mm-hmm. throw for him to be a Republican, and it almost didn't matter. Like, it was all about winning. It didn't matter that it involved these horrific, the racist policies and screwing poor mm-hmm. people and so forth. It was just all about being, you know, the rebel against the establishment. I think there's a lot of self-flattery in those. But I am really interested in this I always think that, I'm always trying to give away this idea. I think that magazine should have a page called I Was Wrong. And people should explain how it is that they came to change their mind about something fundamental. Because I think mm-hmm. it's the hardest thing in the world to get mm-hmm. people to explain why it was that they were wrong. In most
right.
cases,
right.
they just say, I was right. The world changed, you know. And even, you know, last week when I had my blow-up with Joe Klein, he was actually saying he was right in that famous quote of his where he said that there was only one conceivable possibility for George Bush, and that was to govern from the responsible center. There would be no tax cut. There would be no nothing.
Right.
He explained that he was actually right when he said that. And I think it's fascinating how good people are at fitting the world into a box which proved what they thought in the first place. And I think right. that political psychologists need to spend a lot more time figuring out how to get people to change their minds. Democrats think, particularly liberals, think that they could just give people a set of facts and it'll change their mind about things. I'll say, oh,
right.
look,
well,
universal health care is a good
idea.
Drew
Weston has a book coming out about this now.
Yeah, you know, I read his TAP piece, which is very good. Put a link on that, people. And also, I saw him speak recently, and he's very good about how the Republicans understand narrative and the Democrats don't. But I think what he's talking about is narrative that reinforces what people already believe. What I want to understand is how to get people to change their mind. How did Robert Kennedy move to the left? You know,
right.
most people move to the right.
Well, I guess one of the reasons I find some of this, you know, you must apologize, everyone must, you know, come clean, you know, I feel like it's kind of a power play by a certain group of writers against another group of writers, which is fine, but the reason I'm not interested in it is because I didn't write word one about the war, and a lot of the people I find who are now, you know, most aggressive about attacking people who were pro-war either did not write much about the war themselves, or were in fact pro-war, and you know, at the time I didn't really know.
Who are you thinking about? Name.
Well, I mean, even just at this magazine, I mean, I think you know, I don't really want to get into it, but you know, I mean, a lot of people were for the war. It was some of them. It was because they were young, and you can't really hold it against them. Some of them, it was because they. It was this sort of trendy position in Washington amongst a certain young group of people. And if you had a dissenting viewpoint, there was no social support for that dissenting viewpoint except amongst people who were about twice your age and who had been socially marginalized in Washington. And so the marginalization pre-existed the view. I just feel like there's a lot of score selling going on right now that I don't find it interesting. What I find interesting is how communities create an environment where other people can't get heard.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just...
I think this historically has been the role of the New Republic, by the way, which is to marginalize those with whom it disagrees, almost always on behalf of Republican wars. At least for the past 34 or so years. And I think that what you're talking about, the New Republic, it's less and less influential, obviously. But when I was a young writer in Washington in the 1980s, and the wars were Ronald Reagan's wars, it did exactly this. It made you feel kind of like a loser if you didn't get with the program, if you didn't understand that. Beinart describes this pretty well, approvingly, in his book. But the idea that there was going to be a democratic liberal way to fight to support Ronald Reagan's wars, and that if you were still stuck in the old nation, America's evil, you know.
But they were right on Kosovo, and they were right on Bosnia.
You know, I changed my mind on Bosnia and Kosovo. That's one fundamental thing where I changed my mind. I was against it, and I was wrong. And
they were there, and I interned there, you know, during the American initiative in Kosovo. And, you know, this was something people at that magazine had been advocating for a very long time, and they helped shape a public consensus for a successful American intervention against a ethnic cleansing initiative, and that was a good thing.
Yeah, just to be fair to myself, to set the record straight for a sec. Kosovo is the only instance I can remember since I've been doing this job where I actually couldn't make up my mind. Or Bosnia. Kosovo I favored. But the whole Bosnia thing, I just couldn't make up my mind. I was paralyzed. I didn't know what to do. Because I had just written a book on democracy and foreign policy, which no one in the world read, which was something I felt very strongly about. And the American
people... Send me a copy, I'll read it.
Just went out of printer. It's about to go out of printer. The American people didn't want that war, you know? They didn't. They couldn't care less about Bosnia or Kosovo.
Right, exactly. It's like Darfur.
It was worse than Darfur. In Darfur, they wouldn't mind it if it were not very costly.
Darfur is this very curious case where it's become, you know, this thing where everybody is organizing around it. There's constantly benefits. Everyone talks about it, you know, in Hollywood and in these speeches, and yet nothing happens.
Well, the thing about Darfur, the reason I stay away from it, I actually have a friend who quit a very good job to do nothing but volunteer work and trying to put the coalition to save Darfur. He's one of the smartest people and most admirable people I know. But I really feel about Darfur that I don't know if anything can be done. I don't know what it is that's supposed to be done. No one has explained to me how it can be fixed. I mean, if we don't have the troops to send there, and we're not going to do that.
So we're too tied down. We can't do it. We can't.
And nobody else
what
is
we're
willing
doing
to do it
right now.
Nobody else is willing to do it.
Right.
And it's not clear that troops are actually the right thing to do.
Right.
So what is?
I just think that whether or not I just feel like whether or not one supported what was going on going against Saddam Hussein, the precedent in terms of U.S. action is that, you know, our military initiatives were at least carried out with a kind of baseline level of competence, and a lot of people, I mean, you know, there's occupation, I mean, the demonstration against occupation in Iraq right now, ongoing today, yesterday, within the narrative of the Middle East, our being there is history going backwards. They got rid of people like us, and we're back. And it's their history going backward, and that kind of regional history, I think, was really not taken into consideration when people thought about going there. But I don't think any of us could say that if there had been a competent administration that had done this differently, it might have turned out to be less of a disaster. It probably would have still been very difficult, but it would have definitely been less of a disaster.
It would have definitely been less of a disaster, but it would have been impossible, I think, nevertheless.
There's no way. We shouldn't be there anymore. We shouldn't have been there this long, doing what we're doing right now. It should never have been part of the plan, and it wasn't part of the plan.
Yeah, I'm not sure what you're arguing here.
Well, I don't know either at this point, but
okay.
I find that there's a kind of score settling that journalists are interested in right now, or just a kind of intellectual journalist is interested in right now with regard to the war, which I don't find interesting because I feel like there was such a consensus to go to war at the time, and I sometimes wonder myself if there hadn't been such a consensus around that. And in the same way that there's such a consensus that everybody's wrong about everything now, you know, other voices would have spoken up. So I'm just suspicious of all consensuses.
I don't feel that way. I'm sure I'm one of those people who is obsessed with settling scores. But as I said, there were a lot of people I admire, people I learned from, people who know something about the history of U.S. foreign policy in the area, who were against this war. And they weren't listened to. They were just shunted aside. They were mocked. Their patriotism was questioned. And those, I think, barring any other evidence, I think those are the people we should be listening to today, because those people have a proven track record of understanding how, you know, the complexity of the issues in which the issues that are raised by
some of them have a proven some of them have a proven track record of recognizing issues, and some of them I don't think you can say that about some of the others.
Of course, it's not true of everyone, but I think the burden should be on people like Bill Kristol and Richard Perle
and so forth.
And the people who are still on television and in the op-ed page, in the Washington Post editorial page.
Richard Perle was in government.
To say, here's why I got it wrong, and here's why you shouldn't dismiss everything I believe. So because, in other words, their track record is listen to me, and the result will be disaster. Now, if they want me to keep listening to them, particularly since
I guess we needed to clarify. I mean, I thought you were talking about the sort of intra-liberal score settling as opposed to the actual sort of pro-administration position.
I'm talking about the intellectual debate. That I'm not just talking about Paul Berman and Peter Beinart. I'm talking about everyone who was involved in this debate. And what I'm saying is the people who won that debate, not that won it, but who were on the side that won, which was George Bush's side, those people have, their judgment has all been proven very bad, to be terrible, on the most important issue of the past couple of decades. Now, fine, it's possible to be a good person and to be a very good analyst and to still be wrong. The world is a very unpredictable place. But what I'm saying is if they want me to keep listening to them and take them seriously, they need to explain why it is they got it wrong and what they've learned. Because those same damn people are saying, let's attack Iran right now. And I'm saying, I've had enough of you people. You don't know what the hell you're talking about. And unless you can explain to me why, you know, what it is you've learned, you shouldn't even be allowed in the room to debate these things anymore. I mean, that's a little extreme, but that's actually what I think. I mean, you know, if these people had been president of corporations, they would be fired. If they had any kind of baseline responsibility for the result of their actions, they'd be gone, just like most of the people in the Pentagon are now gone.
Bill Kristol runs his own magazine. He's not going to fire himself.
Huh?
I said Bill Kristol runs his own magazine. He's not going to
fire
himself.
No, but they should be fired by the networks that employ them. They should be fired by, you know, the Washington Post shouldn't have exactly the same people on its editorial page who were advocating for this catastrophe. They should have learned from their mistakes and invited in new voices. Time magazine should not have picked virtually all columnists who supported this war as, you know, when they relaunched. They should have picked people who had shown greater prescience. Look, I always bring up the same issue. I'm tired of hearing myself talk about it, so I'll drop it. But I just think it's not about score settling. It's about the fact that we have been badly misled in this country by our political class. And it's and ironically, they made exactly the same damn mistake they made in Vietnam. So if we're going to not keep making this mistake and killing innocent people and losing our brave soldiers and creating hatred against ourselves, we need to figure out what went wrong. And nobody's really interested in doing that.
I think what went wrong started at the top, though. I mean, I think the press is part of it, but it started at the top, and it starts with Bush. The entire system of checks and balances between the press and the politicians broke down because somebody discovered somewhere along the way that if you just ignore press and you work through the scandal, then you can just keep going. And then what did they have left? What does the press have left? The revelations, if you have no sense of shame, then the press has very little influence over you.
It's true. It's true. But the press could have become an opposition press, say, the way that The Guardian is in England. And they didn't have the courage to do that. The way The Guardian and the BBC both did, by the way. The BBC, of all things, the institution of the state, became an opposition press against a liberal government. And our press became a lapdog press for a conservative government. I think that's a perfectly fair comparison to make.
Well, speaking of people who should be fired, there's a great deal of controversy about Don Imus right now. And it certainly seems as though he should probably be fired. And it's entertaining to watch the movement building against him at this moment in time. It seems like it's well-deserved, and he has a very long and unpleasant history of just saying tremendously awful things about people and being completely ignored and given this huge and tremendous platform. And it's good to see that people are starting to hold figures like him accountable for what they say. Because words have meanings, and they set social norms, and they make it okay to say certain things and to think certain things and to, you know, to think that, oh, it's just normal to, you know, call Hillary Clinton a bitch and, you know, and talk about, you know, young African-American women as, quote, nappy-headed hoes, as Don Imus called the women on the Rutgers basketball team, women's basketball team.
Did you happen to read David Carr's column in the Times today about this?
No, actually I didn't. I read his piece a couple days ago.
He wrote a very good column today. It was about the role that Imus plays for the establishment press and how important he is to inviting them on his show to discuss issues, and he treats them respectfully. He plugs their books. Imus actually made Howie Kurtz a big bestseller years ago. Mm-hmm. And that's why they don't want to rock this vote. They don't want to. They want to give him a pass. They want it all to go away, and that the opposition to this is being led by, unfortunately, by people like Al Sharpton, who do this for, you know, a living. And to me, there's no way to judge when Al Sharpton is objecting to something, whether it's legitimate or not, because, you know, it's just his job to object on behalf of black people, regardless of whether or not there's any merit to the issue. So I'm actually disappointed. Today the story may have turned a bit, but I think you're absolutely right. Imus has been saying this kind of thing for decades. MSNBC has had him on there, and there's incident after incident where he says these things. He was unbelievably disrespectful of Bill Clinton at not the White House Correspondents' Dinner, but the one of the broadcast dinners when Clinton was sitting there during the Monica thing. Much, much more so than Stephen Colbert could be accused of being towards Bush. And it was much less of a big deal because Imus is really good to these people, and they like him, and he's respectful for them, to them, and they're very reluctant to part with that. There's so few places that journalists feel like they get to talk seriously before a large audience, and Imus mm-hmm. provides that. I think that if they do manage to force MSNBC and I guess it's NBC Radio. I'm not sure about that. To get rid of him would be a real victory because he's really.
Well, I think people are really figuring out how to mobilize now. And between the African American organizations, it's not just Al Sharpton. You know, it's the editor of Ebony Magazine or Essence Magazine. It's the editor. The head of the NAACP, one of the local branches. I mean, there's a lot of people who are interested in making a cause out of this. There's the group of Color of Change. I believe it's the sort of African American Move On group that has been doing a lot of work around Fox right now. I feel like there's a group of people who are developing a skill at doing these media campaigns against people who are saying things that they think are very offensive. And the people from the networks are really distancing themselves very forcefully from Imus, which is new. And I think just what's happened this year, I mean, we've just seen this stream of people who have just embarrassed themselves and who have said these things, which apparently they think it's okay to say, and which must have been okay to say because they've been saying them for years. And for some reason, in the last year or the last 6 months, it's no longer okay anymore. And well, I think that's a very, very interesting turn, you know, and you start with Mel Gibson, Michael Richards, you know, Ann Coulter, and it just, something's flipped. I don't know if it's a generational shift, but I feel like we've hit a cultural tipping point, and there are a lot of people who are suddenly getting into trouble and are going to keep getting into trouble, and I think it's a good thing.
I wish I could agree with you. I think these are fill-ups in these people's careers. I think that, you know, ABC and CNN hired Glenn Beck, and he says this kind of things all the time. He always calls Hillary Clinton a bitch. MSNBC tried to hire Michael Savage. He just went over the line for them, but they would have been happy if he had danced up to the line. In New York, we've always had these shock jocks who are basically racist.
No, I remember.
There was a guy named Bob Grant for a long time. I was on a show once. I didn't know what I had gotten myself into. And they're just racist. And Rush Limbaugh is a racist. No question. If you look at what Limbaugh says, he's always, he had that example after example. If you go to Media Matters page, of Limbaugh, you know, playing Moving On Up whenever he mentioned Senator Carol Moseley Braun. There are a bunch of examples like that. And this is considered edgy. This is considered hip. Right. This is considered cool. It's the old men at the networks chasing what they think is a younger audience, which is where the advertising dollars are. And I think, you know, you say that there's you're encouraged, but I think, look, this didn't hurt Ann Coulter at all. Ann Coulter's doing just great. Ann Coulter was on CNN the other day, as far as I saw it on Natrios or something, or Matt Yglesias. These people still have very good careers. Michael Richard is disposable. He's an out-of-work actor who had no career at all. So, naturally, we're all going to pile on him. But I think Imus is going to be fine, unfortunately. I think that, you know, it's kind of like Michael Jackson. You know, Michael Jackson, for years, his stories were well-known about him allegedly molesting small children. And then his career kind of went in the tank. And it all of a sudden became possible to talk about them. But as long as these guys are making a lot of money for the networks, and the networks are going to be behind them, and a lot of things are just going to be swept under the rug. And that's just the way capitalism is. Money trumps almost everything. I mean, it'd be interesting
to see.
That's
a cynical perspective. I guess I disagree, because I think that the Democrats have had some success with their pushback against Fox, and I think that they had some success with their pushback against Ann Coulter. And I think that they, you know, yeah, she's going to continue to be around, but it's not going to be the same. I mean, she jumped the shark. She just doesn't have, it's over for her. It's all downhill from here, you know? And I mean, she's not going to be impecunious, and she's not going to be, you know, completely outcast. I mean, that's not how these things work, but it's just, she's not going to be in the same place that she was, and she isn't.
But Grant, I mean, maybe you're right. Neither one of us can say for sure. But she was on CNN. She was respectfully interviewed as a guest on CNN. That means she's not an outcast. That means she's a respected and admired voice. Pat Robinson, you know, he made those comments about how we got what was coming on 9/11. He's made all kinds of anti-Semitic comments over the years. He's treated incredibly respectfully by these citizens. Jerry Falwell accused Clinton of committing murder. He doesn't go away. You know, these people represent real power in our society, and real power is more powerful than Al Sharpton. I mean, unless Al Sharpton somehow got real power. I mean, Fox is doing, you know, they're doing a debate with the Congressional Black Caucus, even after the whole, even after we've lived through this just a month ago in Nevada. You know, they're Fox is completely discredited in terms of being a fair and balanced news network, but they're powerful. Rupert Murdoch has a lot of money. They've got a lot of viewers. They, by cable standards, they have a lot of viewers, and so they win. You know, that's what wins.
Well, maybe the pushback is not as significant as you would like it to be, but I do think that it's significant as compared to what, you know, existed 5 years ago.
I absolutely agree with that. I think that,
and that's why I think it's significant. And if Fox is going to continue to exist as a station, I mean, it's not going out of business. I mean, but these pushbacks, you know, they do mean something. They're a sign of something.
I think they're great. I think that the Move On and the Blogosphere and the Center for American Progress and Media Matters and the American Prospect and all of these institutions are incredibly valuable, because 5 or 6 years ago, there was nothing like them. There was no pushback at all. They could do this stuff with absolute impunity, and people on the other side felt like they had absolutely nowhere to turn. And now they feel like they have somewhere to turn, and that there are other people on their side, and there's a fight to be made. And, you know, John Edwards is like, he's sort of the presidential candidate of this kind of thing, and that's real progress. But I still think that these other forces are way, way more powerful.
I mean, it's a national network is obviously much more powerful than the Reverend Al Sharpton, who at most can command 150,000 votes in New York City. I mean,
it's also, there's a whole other problem, which is Al Sharpton himself. I mean, I wish...
I've read about Al Sharpton before. I'm sorry?
I said, one thing I love about Barack Obama is that he's not Al Sharpton.
He's so different. He just comes from a completely different cultural milieu and just totally different background.
I guess what I'm saying is I think that it's a little touchy for a white Jewish male to say, but I think that there's been a crisis.
Well, you've never shied away from saying touchy things, Eric Alterman.
Okay. I'm not shying away. I'm just allowing for the fact that I'm going to try and say it as carefully as I can, that there's been a crisis of black leadership in this country since the Civil War, Civil Rights generation.
Hopefully not since the Civil War.
And I used to actually, this is one thing where I have become more conservative. I used to really get disgusted with the New Republic for always harping on Jesse Jackson's flaws and so forth. And I do think they probably did too much of it. But the fact is that the generation of black politicians, either the establishment politicians like Charlie Rangel or the anti-establishment politicians like Sharpton and Jackson, in terms of not being elected officials, they have nothing to show for their efforts. There's no powerful black presence, or more important to me, actually, poor people's presence. Poor people have very precious little voice in our system because they've been so balkanized. And I think that one thing I love about Barack Obama, I'm not saying I support him for president, but one thing I love about his rise as a national voice is he's not a balkanizing presence. He's a uniting
right.
presence. And he's saying, I've just been listening to his first book on tape. It's a wonderful thing to hear it in his voice, actually. It's very moving.
He read it himself?
He read it himself, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Which is really, really hard. I read What Liberal Media on to
go. It's a long book, too, to read yourself. That must have taken a very long time.
It's not the entire book. It's
excerpts from it. Because the whole book, I mean, it would have taken him... It would take a lot of commuting.
I think it's 8 CDs. It's a longish part. Anyway, but the idea of saying, growing up the way I did, black in America and also Indonesia, gives me certain insights that wouldn't be available to someone else, but I'm going to use those insights to bring people on who haven't had that experience together and try and help out, try and create a coalition rather than try and just speak for my own narrow slice. Sharpton and Jackson, I think, have been disasters for black people in America because black people are first and foremost, not all of them, but they're disadvantaged. Most black people are poor or are not nearly as well-to-do as white people. And
I don't think the majority are poor. I think it's in the it's a higher percent than among whites, but it's not the majority.
Yeah. Okay. I'm interested in politics, and that's why I'm trying to I'm sort of tripping over my words because I'm making a couple of points that maybe don't fit together that well. But I'm interested in a politics that fights back in this class war that the rich have been able to carry out against the poor for the past 20, 30 years. And I think one reason that it's been so successful is that poor people have been divided in part by their own leadership and in part by their own identities, their commitment to identity politics. And I think that the black leadership has made its name on this kind of identity politics. And I really appreciate Barack Obama for refusing to fall into that trap, for saying, I'm not walking away from my identity. I'm proud of my identity. In fact, you can learn a lot from the experiences that I've had as a member of my particular racial and ethnic minority. But I'm going to use that to bring us together rather than to assert my claim as a black man. And I think that that's exactly, that's an incredibly salutary thing in our politics at this moment.
I think if you live in New York, the world looks very different.
That's for damn sure.
That's what I think. I don't know, maybe I just, I feel like people who came through the 80s, there was this area of identity politics that I missed. I caught the tail end of that with the rise of the gay rights movement, which mm-hmm. was, generally speaking, a good thing, and which the left had nothing to do with at all.
That's not fair.
No, there were these huge arguments in New York in the late 80s about whether or not liberals cared about gay rights, and it was this huge thing when Andrew Sullivan moved to the New Republic and started writing about, you know, gay issues.
There's a great Paul Berman's book on this. The chapter in his book on that originally appeared as the world's longest New Republic essay is really great on the history of the gay rights movement, and I think it definitely grew out of the other liberation movements of the 60s, other left wing liberation movements of the 60s.
Sorry, I'm just motioning. There's someone coming into the room who wants to use. Get a book, so I'm just motioning her around the table.
Okay.
I haven't read that essay.
Anyway,
Barack Obama certainly represents. His experience living in Indonesia as well, and having an understanding of the third world and of poverty, and a little bit of an understanding of the Islamic world as a normal place. you know, I think it makes him very appealing to some, a lot of people, and his ability to sense in people what his position has. His position has been to always be a little bit of an outsider, and so therefore to try and have to figure out what he has in common with the people who he's around, because he has not been like mm-hmm. them. And so he has a gift for sensing what unites people and what they might have in common, even though they're different from him. And I think people who are looking for a kind of pugnacious partisanship are looking for something different than what he's offering in that, because they're afraid that this means that he's not going to be aggressive enough in fighting the right wing, for example, mm-hmm. or fighting people who they think he should fight. But it doesn't seem to me that that's really what he's doing. It's more about trying to figure out what are people's core values, and where do they stand, and how can you reach across these boundaries between people and between cultures, mm-hmm. and arrive at a consensus where you're able to be together as and at peace together.
That's a good way of putting it. Grant, you were recently involved in a lengthy debate with other members of your magazine, The American Prospect, over Hillary Clinton's candidacy. Why don't you talk a little bit about that, and tell us if it had any effect on your view of that candidacy. You're basically supportive. You think she'd be a good Democratic nominee, or maybe you think she ought to be the nominee. What's your current view on that?
Well, I mean, I'm not taking a position on who should be the Democratic nominee. First of all, it's way too early, and second of all, I don't think that's the role that I want to take for myself.
Okay.
But we had a debate that we published in the magazine about Hillary Clinton, in which I argued that her gender made her unique in ways that I felt that we needed to take into consideration. And so I laid out what some of those ways were, and I felt that a lot of the attacks on her are not fully understanding what it is that she's doing as a candidate. And there was just a piece in the LA Times also yesterday talking about Clinton, and it said that she's not afraid to play the gender card. And this is, I think, the core of what the debate was about, was this question of whether or not women together, working together for a political end, is somehow, there's an illegitimacy to it, that somehow gender is not something that can be considered a legit, that there's no set of issues there, there's no set of communications that happen there, there's no worldview that exists there that can be tapped into, and therefore the whole thing's just illegitimate, and, you know, we should all just judge her just like anybody else, except that women aren't. And so she has this huge gap between the men who support her versus Barack Obama, so she's basically tied with Barack Obama amongst a lot of Democratic Party men, but she's got these 20-point, 25-point gaps in most of the polls in different states, where women just support her so much more.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think it makes it interesting. And the question is, you know, well, why is this? And is it because women are seeing something in her candidacy that men aren't seeing, or is it because men are downgrading her candidacy? Is it some mixture of the two? And I think one of the things that's been most disturbing to me in this whole discussion is this idea that somehow the progressive perspective is this, like, neutral male, and that the female perspective on this is the variant, when in fact 60% of Democratic voters in primaries are female, and the majority of Democratic Party voters are female, and every single sociological survey that I have seen about people who consider themselves progressive and liberal shows that the majority of them are female. And so the idea that what women are thinking about this is somehow not progressive but womanly somehow, and outside there and not part of this political worldview that people have, is something I find just deeply disturbing.
Yeah, but I don't know, I don't see that anywhere. I don't know what you mean.
I see it everywhere. I mean, like, this is like the core of our whole discussion on the blog. And then there was this piece on, you know, Sadly No had something about this as well. And, you know, there's this idea that it's illegitimate for women to organize politically for female electoral power.
Oh, I agree with that. I mean, I think it's wrong for people to organize for gender or racial or ethnic power, period. I think it's a mistake.
Well, that's what I'm saying, yeah. Right. That's the perspective that you have that I disagree with, because the fact of the matter is when I came to this country in 1978, there was about 4% of the Congress was female. In 1960, there was, I'm sorry, it was 3% in 1977. You know, in 1960, there was 4% women graduating from law schools. Nothing that has happened in terms of the transformation of women's power, their political power, has happened because anybody except themselves, because anybody's given it to them. It's all because women have organized for themselves. Emily's List came into existence.
I can't hear you.